We are well placed, of course, in terms of natural resources for the green energy transition, not just for our own use, but for all countries racing to the net zero deadline. But is there a danger that we dig up minerals that are in demand and ship them out without adding any value? How does Australia move up the renewables value chain? That's this week.
The Morning Call from NAB with Phil Dobby.
The Weekend Edition.
With the usual disclaimer that the views expressed on the Weekend Edition don't necessarily mirror the views of NAB because, well, actually, there's nobody from NAB here. But I don't think there's anything too contentious today. Just a little bit thought-provoking. So stay with us, because as the world moves swiftly to renewable energy, much of that is reliant on battery power. And we are obviously very fortunate in Australia because we've got large reserves of lithium. So do we become as reliant on lithium mining as we have been on coal and iron ore? Well, maybe not, because there are many other minerals and resources that the world wants that we can also provide a lot of. But there's also stuff like coal that increasingly the world doesn't want. So how advantageous is our position right now? Can we replace the old stuff with the minerals that the renewable industry is demanding? Well, Alison Reeve is Energy and Climate Deputy Programme Director at the Grattan Institute, the public policy think tank based in Melbourne. Alison, I'm looking at the Resources and Energy Quarterly Report from the Department of Energy, Science and Resources from last final quarter of last year, I think it was. It says we had record lithium exports of $20 billion in the year before last, but that's expected to fall to $16 billion this year because they say prices are lower and there's a surplus supply. So I'd have thought with the energy transition that's required to run a fair old lick all around the world, there would be incessant demand for lithium right now.
Phil, thanks so much for having me on. It's really nice to be here. To go to your question, there is a growing demand for lithium, but a lot of other countries are getting in onto the act. There are resources coming from South America, for example. Australia does have 50% of the world's known reserves of lithium, so we are pretty well placed to take some of that growth. The thing is, though, that like any other commodity that you mine, lithium sort of goes through one of those cycles of tight supply, lots of people pile in and invest in the mines, and then you suddenly get the supply outstripping the demand and the price falls again. Some of this will just be a matter of waiting for the demand to catch up to the surplus of lithium that there is at the moment. But then that whole cycle will start again. So it's not really that different to mining any other resource from that perspective.
Right. And are we going to keep our share, or a lot of these competitors going to be able to do it much cheaper than we can?
That sort of depends. When we look at the competitors, we're often looking at a different form of lithium. So lithium that's sort of found in a brine, like a really salty water. And the way that you get that lithium out is by evaporating the water off. So countries like Chile, for example, have a lot of lithium that comes in that form. Now, Chile's production actually fell in the last couple of years because the weather was particularly bad and they weren't getting the evaporation that they thought, right? You know, the ponds were not drying up fast enough. The sort of lithium Australia has is hard rock lithium. So that means basically we need to dig up a lot of rock and grind it down and then chemically treat it to liberate the lithium. The thing about that process is it is a lot more energy intensive, but where Australia is blessed is that we also have really great reserves of renewable energy that can power that process. And the thing about it is it's a lot more in our control than brine extraction, which tends to be a little bit more weather dependent, at least in the way that it's done now.
But it still sounds expensive doing all of that. And if we're using renewables to do it, does that make it even more expensive? Because obviously what we don't want is a process, and this is the one thing that's leveled. I mean, I've just bought an electric car and everyone's going, you're still doing harm to the environment. You do realize the resources that are required to extract that lithium. And a number of times I've had that conversation in the last month, I can't tell you. The process you're saying is quite extensive and therefore quite expensive, isn't it?
It's not that different to mining a lot of other minerals, right? You know, pretty much almost everything that we consume will have minerals involved in it somewhere. And the way that we the processes that we use for mining those and then processing them apply just as much to lithium and to lots of the other sort of new economy minerals like cobalt and zinc and copper and so on. They, you know, apply just as much to that as they do with iron ore, and they have an impact. Everything that we do has an impact on the environment. The question, I guess, is more how much impact. The firms that are getting into using renewables to do this are doing this because it's cheaper than using diesel. When you're off in a really remote area and you have to ship the diesel out a very long way, it gets really expensive really fast, and also you're exposed to the global oil price. So as soon as there's a war in the Middle East, or Russia invades Ukraine, or OPEC, you know,
or whatever happens next, yeah. So what are they using then? Are they using solar or?
So in Australia, what looks great in a lot of the remote areas is mostly solar with some batteries for storage, and then at the moment, generation for backup. And, you know, particularly if you're running like 24-hour shifts, you need something at night, because it is still quite expensive to build out all the batteries that you need to run the entire mine if you're running a 24/7 operation. So what people are looking at mostly is using renewables to supplement and reduce the amount of diesel or gas that they're using for electricity.
So these figures might not be exactly right, but even if lithium remained at the sort of record levels we saw a couple of years ago of 20 billion a year, that is very small compared to iron ore exports, which were 120 billion last year, thermal coal, 65 billion. So will we, and I know there's more than just lithium, but all of these rare earth minerals that are, you know, that the world is demanding, will we ever get to the stage where it's enough to replace, you know, all the dirty stuff that we've been exporting around the world?
Yeah. So if Australia maintains its current share of the so-called critical minerals, so the minerals that are needed for the energy transition, which are sort of lithium, nickel, cobalt, zinc, copper, and some of the rare earth metals, if we maintain our current market share percentage-wise, with the projected growth that's needed to do the global energy transition, we will actually more than replace the income that we get from thermal and metallurgical coal at the moment by 2050, because they're, you know, the amount of lithium that the world is projected to need is going to grow by something like, I think, 5,000%. Over between 2020 and 2050 is an absolutely huge amount of growth that will take place. So all we need to do is to keep the same percentage of world markets as we've got now, and we should, at least in value, more than replace the value that we're getting from coal.
And should we move up the value chain a little bit as well? I mean, you know, Australia's been, you know, renowned for digging up and shipping out. Could we dig up, add a bit of value and ship out?
Definitely. That's something that is actually a real opportunity for Australia, because processing minerals, no matter whether it's iron ore or, you know, turning that into steel, or whether it's lithium or whether it's nickel, those are all really energy intense processes. And what we've kind of done in the past is we've dug up the ore and we've dug up the coal or the gas, and we've sent those off to other people to put together to turn into metals and then into other products. The opportunity that we have as the world moves away from using coal and using gas is to use the renewable endowment that we've got to do some of that processing here. Now, I will be a bit cautious about this, because it's really important to understand every individual value chain and to understand where Australia's advantage begins and ends. So just because you've got lots of lithium doesn't mean that you should make electric cars. But it could mean that you go part of the way up the battery value chain, you know, to the point where things like labor costs or imported materials start to outweigh the savings that you're making from having the lithium here and having the energy here. You know, so that's the point where you want to stop and start selling that product on to someone else in another country who's got lower, you know, lower labor costs or access to the other materials that are needed, and to turn those things into batteries and then into electric cars.
Right. But some form of processing happening within Australia is.
Absolutely.
So are customers, I mean, by and large, it's China, isn't it? Are we becoming too reliant on China?
China's definitely got a bit of a chokehold on one part of the battery value chain at the moment, and also on things like solar panels and some parts of wind turbines as well. And I think there is a lot of concern in a lot of countries about what happens when you allow one country to dominate part of the chain. And so a lot of countries are looking to do is to diversify their supply and also diversify where their manufacturing is coming from. I'm a little bit cautious about going all the way and going, well, then Australia just needs to make everything it needs. You know, we tried that in the 1950s and 60s, and anyone who remembers having an Australian-made TV and then thinks about the TV that they've got now will realise that, you know, often it is, you know, that this is how trade works, right? You know, you do the bits where you've got the comparative advantage and you let someone else do the other part. But, yeah, I mean, there are certainly, I think, concerns out there about, I guess, more the security and geopolitical risk of allowing one country to dominate so much of a value chain that is so important to so many other countries.
But how do you diversify? I mean, if China is so dominant right now, if you are extracting those minerals and China is a ready market, you're just going to send it to China. It's hard to say, well, okay, you need to diversify for the national interest if you're getting the best value from shipping to China.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're not the only people who are working on this. And China is not the only country that's interested in this manufacturing either. Like, you know, India is making some big strides in becoming, you know, a centre for making hydrogen, a centre for manufacturing solar. And they would also potentially be somewhere where you would be looking at battery manufacturing. The amount of money that the US has put in the Inflation Reduction Act means that a lot of manufacturers are choosing to set up there. And so that, you know, that benefits us as well, being able to sell into the US. So it's probably about, I think it's like anything. And we sort of saw this, you know, when China was putting tariffs on a lot of our other commodities, you know, we found other markets. You know, we found other markets elsewhere for things like barley and wheat and so on. And even though China has now removed its tariffs, we now have those other markets too. So, you know, diversifying, it takes a little bit of time, but it's always a smart thing to do, right? And maybe that's just something that we need to think about more generally with trade, is to think about having a diversity of markets to sell to.
What I find curious, and this is just an aside, but maybe it also says something about, you know, how serious in general is the average Australian behind this shift to renewables. So electric car consumption, purchases of electric cars in 2022, I mean, these figures, you know, might have moved on a little bit. 5% of new cars sold in Australia were electric. So that's either fully electric or plug-in hybrids, compared to 21% for the EU, 23% for the UK, 29% for China. So a bit behind the curve, aren't we, when it comes to actually, you know, I mean, even gas-guzzling America is 8%, and here we are on 5%.
Yeah. One of the things that's held back electric cars in Australia is that manufacturers haven't wanted to send the models here. So the Australians might really want to buy them, but they're just not available here. One of the reasons that they weren't available was that all of those countries you just mentioned have some form of vehicle emission standard, which means that manufacturers are obliged to reduce the overall emissions that the fleet that they sell is responsible for. And that does a lot to encourage not just more efficient petrol cars, but also electric vehicles as well. And so, you know, that we don't have, you know, enough electric vehicles at the moment worldwide for everyone who wants them. And so manufacturers were sending them to the countries where they knew they had a higher chance of selling them. Now, Australia is in the process of setting up a vehicle emission standard. That legislation is going to be in Parliament this year sometime, I think. And what that should do is mean that manufacturers are more willing to send models here. And so more Australians will have a chance to buy an electric car. One of the things too is that, so if you're in the ACT had 25% of new car sales were electric last year. And that's partly because it's a wealthier state you know, lot,
I was going to say, because we pay our politicians too much. Is that a sign of that?
Well, most of the politicians don't live there, but, you know, it was wealthier. And there are also more people who had access to salary packaging, and there were some tax changes that the government made when they were first elected that made it much more attractive to salary package an electric car. And that's really driven uptake in the ACT. So I think there's, you know, a fair bit of kind of latent demand there, but it needs the price to come down a bit, and it also needs a greater range of models to be available so that everyone's got one that suits their needs.
Yeah, for sure. And it was just an aside. What about if, and it's hard to pick the technology, isn't it? So if we invest heavily in lithium and then we find it's surpassed by, for example, sodium ion batteries, which, you know, might be cheaper, might be easier to recycle. Because, I mean, that's one big problem for lithium batteries, isn't it? That, you know, what do you do with it when they don't work anymore? And I'm sure there'll be other technologies that come along as well. How easy is it to transition from producing one to producing another, or, you know, extracting the appropriate resources? Or could we find that we just become isolated because we're pursuing some minerals that are less relevant because there's cheaper alternatives which are more globally available?
Yeah, this is always the risk, right? And I mean, this is why I think it's, I was saying before, it's really important to understand what that value chain looks like, but also look at what are the threats to that value chain. You know, what are the things that could mean that your, you know, the thing you thought was a safe bet doesn't turn out to be a safe bet. And I mean, I think this goes for, you know, when governments are deciding what to support as well, they need to have some pretty clear-eyed look at that sort of thing too. So, you know, don't put all of the eggs in the lithium basket. Maybe put some money into backing sodium ion battery development in Australia as well, you know, so that you've got as many possible horses in the race, and then you've got much more chance of picking a winner.
Right. And what about hydrogen? Because, I mean, there's two schools of thought, aren't there? Those people, I mean, Toyota, I know, is a pre-selling in some parts of the world, pre-selling hydrogen cars. Other people saying, well, hydrogen cars are never going to make it. But hydrogen is very good for heavy industry. So, for example, in Australia's case, perhaps it could help clean up steel production, energy-intensive industries like that. So what's your take on where hydrogen sits?
Yeah. So hydrogen is going to be important, I think, for the industrial sector. There are some things in the industrial sector that you can't do with electricity, and that's either because you need a hydrogen molecule for a chemical process, so things like plastics manufacturing or ammonia manufacturing, for example, or because you need really, really high temperature heat, which is a lot harder to do with electricity. You know, it's much easier if you've got something that you can burn, and hydrogen, when it burns, is actually very high temperature. So that's kind of the niche that hydrogen is going to have. It's not going to be, you know, back in sort of 2018, 2019, it was kind of the everything molecule, the everything everywhere molecule, right? It was going to replace every energy source that you could think of in the economy. But really going forward, what we're seeing is that it's actually electricity that's the everything everywhere energy source, right? That's what we're going to be using for the majority of transport, for the majority of energy that we use in our homes, for large amounts of energy that we use in the industrial and light industrial and commercial sectors. And so hydrogen will have a niche for things like making steel, making ammonia and fertilizer and explosives, and potentially some things like alumina refining as well, and maybe sustainable aviation fuel. But, you know, that's good. And I guess the thing is, when I say it's a niche, it's still a very large change from where we are now, and it still requires an awful lot of renewable energy to put in place to make that hydrogen. So, you know, it's still actually really big. It's just not the massive thing that we used to think that it was.
So it's not going to clean up the steel industry in a hurry then?
I think it looks like the most prospective thing for turning at least iron ore into green iron. But how quickly that happens in Australia, I think, depends on how quickly that moves overseas, because Australia doesn't do a huge amount of steel manufacturing at the moment. And it sort of needs the bigger steel manufacturing countries and bigger companies to take the lead on that tech while it's expensive, so that that can start to drive the cost down and it becomes more of an option in Australia.
So is this the government's aim, though? Because they've got the National Hydrogen Strategy, the review that's underway. They've closed submissions, but so we're waiting for the report. But, I mean, their aspiration is that Australia is on a path to be, I always love government words, it's like we won't be the global leader, but we'll be on the path to be a global leader, global hydrogen leader by 2030 on both an export basis and for the decarbonisation of Australian industries.
Yes.
So, I mean, is that the right thinking?
Yeah, it is. We need to remember that when we say Australian industries, we don't mean all industries. We mean the industries where hydrogen is the right solution. And when we say exports, you know, people used to talk about hydrogen as if we were going to export it in the way that we do LNG. The problem with that is that you have to fight physics all the way. Hydrogen does not like, it's a really, really tiny, incredibly lightweight molecule, and it really doesn't like being compressed down and frozen so that it will stay in a state that you can transport it on a ship. The better thing that we would do with exports is actually use the hydrogen here to produce something that's a lot easier to handle, like green iron, or like ammonia, or like green alumina, because we already know how to export iron and alumina and ammonia because we already do that. So it actually makes more sense to make the hydrogen here, use it to process some of the minerals that we've got, and then send that product overseas as our export industry.
And what about the idea, this $1 billion, which is being earmarked to bring more solar manufacturing onshore? So, solar is a no-brainer, isn't it, for Australia? But there's already a lot of solar, a lot of houses. I'm not quite sure what the percentage is, but there's a lot of them out there.
Up to like a quarter of houses in Australia now have solar on
as
them.
You'd imagine. But does it make sense to bring more manufacturing onshore?
Solar manufacturing is a really brutal business. It's really cutthroat. And if you look at, say, the companies that were in the top 10 for solar manufacturing in 2008, only one of them is still in the top 10. Seven have gone bankrupt, and the other two have pulled out of solar manufacturing and pivoted to something else. And the reason this happens is because the price of solar is falling so fast. And so when you build a new solar facility, you've only got a couple of years before you get undercut by a competitor who can produce the solar panels cheaper than you can. To put that in context, back in 2008, you only had to sell 200 kilowatts of solar in order to get $1 million US in revenue. And now you have to sell close to 4 gigawatts. So that's like you have to sell 8 times as many solar panels to make the same amount of revenue over that time. And so that means that for Australia, our advantage is not necessarily going to be in mass market solar panels because that cost curve is just really brutal. Where Australia's advantage may lie is part of the solar value chain, which is turning sand into silicon. So again, this sort of comes back to the minerals processing thing. That's kind of the first stage in building a solar panel. And that's something that takes a lot of energy. And it's something that we could potentially do cheaper than other people. And then for, you know, that silicon can be exported to other people who do the other work of turning it back into a solar panel, which is much more labor intensive, and then bring that back to Australia. There's also potentially niches in, you know, we tend to think of all solar as being the same, but it's not necessarily going to be all the same. One of the things that often happens with manufacturing is that you have a mass market product, which is absolutely the bailiwick of countries with cheap labor. But then you have niche products where people are prepared to pay a lot more for that product, you know, because maybe it's more efficient or maybe it's more secure and so on. And so there may also be niches in solar for Australia around that as well. And that would be probably a much better place for us to play because we are going to be producing a higher cost product.
And what about government subsidies? Where does that sit? I mean, obviously, Joe Biden has really gone to town, $49 billion for their clean energy transition through the Inflation Reduction Act. So grants, loan guarantees, tax breaks. Should Australia be thinking the same way? And if so, how do you direct it? I mean, you've given quite a few caveats, you know, in the last 20 minutes or so about what we should and shouldn't be doing.
I am being the queen of caveats today, aren't I? look, you know, industry policy is basically back in fashion, and a lot of it is linked to the energy transition and to acting on climate change because we have very little time to, you know, to restructure pretty much every economy in the world to be someone that is net zero emissions. And, you know, markets are not great at doing things at sort of high speed under conditions of high uncertainty. They, you know, capital tends to kind of pull back from going into markets that look like that. And so that's where government does have a role. Australia is not going to be able to match the US dollar for dollar because we just don't have that kind of fiscal capacity in this country. But we can be smart about where we put industry policy. And a lot of that comes back to what I was saying before, like looking for things that are building on our natural advantages, looking for things that we can do better than other people, and also making sure that we understand where the advantage ends. So not just turning lithium into electric cars, but understanding the whole chain of products that happens there and looking at each step in that chain and looking at where, you know, how we keep Australia having an advantage at those particular steps and going no further. So, you know, I think industry policy definitely plays a role in the energy transition. It's just Australia needs to be quite smart about how it does it because otherwise potentially we waste a lot of money and we find ourselves in a situation where no one wants to buy the coal anymore and we haven't built anything to replace it.
And hopefully, you know, if we are adding value in a way that is green and sustainable, the world will catch up at some point to the idea that they are buying cheaper products that are perhaps, you know, are renewable energy resources that have been out with the value added in a less green way. You know, we won't pick on countries, but some of them aren't too far from Australia. And you know, if we've got the green credentials, I mean, maybe, you know, countries will become a little bit more choosy about where they're buying from, and Australia would stand up well in that context.
Yeah, and certainly if you're, you know, a company that's exporting anything to the European Union, you'd be aware of something that they're doing called the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. Where basically they're going to tax the embodied emissions in products when those come into the country. And so if you're able to produce with a lower emissions footprint than other people in a world where those kind of border adjustments exist, then potentially you're at an advantage. There are also, you know, there are also signs of emerging areas where people are prepared to pay that green premium as well. So there were some steel makers who struck a deal with the German car industry to put green steel into German cars. And that happened because the amount that you actually add to the end price of a car by putting green steel in it is really, really low. So the cost, you know, I have seen some work out of ANU that sort of said, well, you know, a consumer would actually pay more to put leather seats in a car than they need to pay to have it made with green steel. And so, you know, where you have things like that, where you can spread that extra cost over a very large number of end consumers in such a way that it's small, those are actually really good for building scale in, you know, moving to things like green steel and other green products.
Well, and look, the more we see examples of climate change happening in our everyday lives, the more we're going to say, well, something has to be done, and then you'd be more prepared to pay that premium, I'm sure. Look, Alison, it's been fascinating talking to you. I've learned a great deal in the last 25 minutes or so, so thanks for coming on. Hopefully we can do it again soon.
Yeah, that would be great. Thanks a lot for having me, Phil.
Knows her stuff, doesn't she? That's Alison Reeve. She is the Energy and Climate Deputy Programme Director at the Grattan Institute. And that is the weekend edition for this weekend. Of course, I am back on Monday morning for our regular weekday edition of The Morning Call. I'll see you then. I'm Phil Dobby for NAB. Thanks for listening.
The Weekend Edition.